very much for the invitation to come here, and it's very nice to be in Hull. I'm going to speak for, I hope, not longer than 45 minutes. There's quite a lot in here, but hopefully with the slides, there'll be at least, you know, some of it that will find some resonance with you. But I'm going to move through quite a sort of spate of sorts of issues. But I'm going to set them up first, and then the talk is in two parts, as I'll explain as I go along. So perhaps the first thing to say, can everybody hear me, by the way, at the back particularly? Great. Perhaps the first thing to say about my title and the topic of my talk today is that both sympathy and empathy are uncertain contenders for being considered emotions at all. The great 18th century philosopher of sympathy, Adam Smith, defines it as a sort of imaginative conduit. It's the process by which we respond to or feel others' emotions through imagining ourselves in their situation. It's accumulated as a result a kind of ambiguity or ambivalence, whether it's primarily in the domain of feeling or of thought, about whether it's innate or acquired, whether it's always a response to a primary emotion, and if so, what kind, and so on. Sympathy has thus the strange quality of being a kind of supplement to or mechanism of emotion proper, and perhaps as a result of this, it's central to the experience of having an emotion at all, especially when we read literature. So my topic today concerns a relatively short part of the long history of sympathy. In fact, I'm learning from Richard that it's longer than I thought about, because he's taking it back further than I ever have done. But I'm focusing on the final decades of the 19th century, and what I'm talking about today draws from thoughts about the book that I'm writing that Richard's mentioned, that I hope in the end, as well as being interesting in its own right, might also help to shed some light on why today we tend to sympathise less than the Victorians did. And that's not primarily because we are more self-centred or care less about other people than the Victorians did, although, of course, those statements might be true, but because now we have an alternative word from around the final decades of the 20th century, empathy became the favoured way that we talk about feeling for and with other people. So the empathy slogan, "I feel your pain," is now a contemporary cliché. If you Google sympathy and empathy, you will find definitions that distinguish them. And they're now distinguished in dictionaries as well. So this is just a little a definition from Oxford Dictionaries, which is a simplified online accompaniment to the authoritative English dictionary, explaining that empathy is, quotes, "the ability to understand and share the feelings of another, while sympathy denotes feelings of pity and sorrow for someone else's misfortune." So a similar emphasis on empathy as a mode of understanding, laterally achieved, if you like, through identification, is common, and sympathy is now more restricted than it was in the 19th century, or the 18th century perhaps, or maybe even the early modern period. Sympathies are now associated more with pity, and it seems to imply as well a distance between the provider and the recipient of the feeling. But these were differences that the Victorians didn't consider. The imaginative putting myself in your place was part of sympathy, as was the process of sharing in another's pain, feeling sorrow for them. So the simple starting point of my work that I'm doing is to question why, Given sympathy's rich history and its undoubted cultural currency, another word was needed to denote this process of feeling with or for others. Unsurprisingly, unsurprisingly, it turns out to be really quite a complex question. How we know that others have minds, thoughts and feelings has been a philosophical conundrum since at least the classical period. And I'm, of course, not going to try to tackle that whole vast subject, but just to give some tiny snapshots from two moments in the 19th century through which I hope I can begin to persuade you that thinking historically about sympathy and empathy might be important for our own debates today about how we think and feel about others. And I'm going to do this through the work of two women writers, rarely, if in fact ever, I think, brought together. One of them, I suspect many of you, if not all of you, will know. George Eliot did as much as any cultural figure in the 19th century to fashion sympathy as a key ethical term for a secularising society where church-going Christianity could no longer bind the community together. The other woman is Vernon Lee, who may be less familiar. Born in 1856 as Violet Paget, which is on the slide there, Vernon Lee is the name that she took. Lee had begun to write, just about begun to write when Eliot died. Eliot we associate with some of the most resonant stereotypes of the Victorian period, a great moral earnestness in place of her lost Christian faith. She's seen as architect and representative of a novelistic realism committed to moral agency. The novel is supposed to make you a better person. Lee, a cosmopolitan figure, lesbian in orientation and desire, if not in overt sexual practice, was a theorist of aesthetics, a critic and story writer who, when she visited England, moved in aesthetic and decadent circles and was very much a figure of the fin de siècle, influenced by Walter Pater and critical of what she deemed worn-out notions of the moral function of art and literature. Yet fascinating parallels exist between these two women whose paths never crossed. Not least that they were both stunning intellectuals and scholars, I think probably the two foremost women intellectuals of the period. Both were deeply and widely read in the scientific literature of their day, and both were especially fascinated by the emerging discipline of psychology. Psychology, we'll find, is centrally important to the story of empathy's birth, in a way that parallels perhaps the role of moral philosophy in the story of sympathy in the 18th century. So my plan today is to look very briefly at what sympathy meant in Eliot's fiction, in George Eliot's fiction, and to suggest that by the time of her final great novel, Daniel Deronda, published in 1876, something's happened to that notion of sympathy. The idea that sympathy begins to come under a kind of strain towards the end of the 19th century is anyway, I think, relatively uncontentious. Certainly confidence about the novel's moral function, its ability to provoke emotion as a spur to moral behaviour, had waned and become subject to aggressive scrutiny. Oscar Wilde reportedly quipping that one must have a heart of stone to read the death of Little Nell without laughing is an image of this diminishing Victorianism and changing attitudes about the goals of literature and art. The critic Stephen Arata, writing about realism at the fin de siècle, notes that, quote, the turn away from sympathy was perceived by many as the defining feature of late Victorian realism. And the French novelist Zola is exemplary here. The late 19th century writer and folklorist Andrew Lang saw the Zola narrator as a figure dedicated to neutrality, abstaining from all comment or revelation of authorial personality. Lang writes, his task is never to turn to the reader for sympathy, but rather to remain as cold as a vivisectionist at a lecture. It's not, though, the case that sympathy is becoming obviously less important by the end of the 19th century, certainly not less discussed. And a while ago I did an extremely unrigorous and unscientific exercise of looking at hits for sympathy on a major database, the British Periodicals Database, the ProQuest one. I don't know if you have it here at Hull. It's a really fantastic database. It contains about 500 publications that span from late 17th to early 20th century. And it covers all sorts of publication frequencies and topics ranging from literature and history to social sciences and music and art. And it gives a global hit. If you just type in sympathy, it gives a global hit of getting on for 500,000 hits for sympathy. But if you break it down by decade, you'll see there 1800 to 1809 shows nearly 3,000 records. And then it rises steadily until the 1860s, where it spikes suddenly to 56,000. And then it levels off to the peak until it gets to the peak decade, which is the 1890s, where the number of records stand at just over 65,000. And thereafter, there's a sharp drop. And I have to say, as a scholar of the 1890s, I didn't expect to see that. I was very surprised to see that the decade in which there's the most hits for sympathy is actually the 1890s. But one of the places where sympathy is being discussed, we know, and I'm going to come back to this shortly, is in the pages of specialist and general periodicals dedicated to and defining the new discipline of psychology. In 1873, writing to a friend, George Henry Lewis, George Eliot's partner, and one of the foremost contributors to this new discipline, wrote to a friend that sympathy is one of the great psychological mysteries, and as a psychologist, I am bound to explain it, but can't. So after looking briefly at what's happening to Eliotian sympathy in the 1870s, I'm then going to move forward two decades to the 1890s, and two women engaged on a rather peculiar project together. They call it an experiment, and what they're doing is looking at art of all kinds, and recording what happens to them as they look. And I'm going to come back to this and explain it to you properly in a little while. They write up their findings and publish them in the reputable Contemporary Review. And in the decade that followed, Vernon Lee, Violet Paget, Vernon Lee, one of these women, disappointed by the relative lack of response to her article in Britain, but intrigued that it had been noticed in Germany, began more systematically to read the psychological literature there. And Germany was way ahead in psychology. It was the first place that effectively developed what we now call experimental psychology. The first psychological laboratory was opened in Germany. And Lee realised that the theory she'd come up with to account for what she'd found in these strange experiments that she did with her friend at looking at art, trying to answer the question of what art does with us, is how she characterised it, to explain the mystery of aesthetic responsiveness, why we find some things beautiful and other things ugly, had in fact in Germany already been identified and named. It was called Einfühlung, and this German word was translated around 1908 as empathy. And I'm going to come back to that, because the birth of empathy is a stranger story than many of us, I think, might believe. But first of all, a little bit about Eliot, to set us up for thinking a little bit more about Victorian sympathy and what's happening to it as we get towards the final decades of the 19th century. To follow the young Marian Evans from her youthful evangelicalism to the Holy War, of her lost Christian faith and her fights with her father, and via the free-thinking friends, the Brazen Hennels, to the impact of translating Ludwig Feuerbach's work, the work that really settled her view of what of a kind of humanism, reading Comte and Herbert Spencer, is to track a powerful thread of Victorian intellectual, spiritual and cultural upheaval. For Eliot, sympathy was the human face turned foremost against the rejected dogmas of Christianity. It was from the outset imbricated with her theory of what art, and especially the novel, could and should do. As she writes in a now famous essay of 1856 in the Westminster Review, the journal that she was the editor for, just about a year before she penned her first fiction. This is an essay that's now much quoted in Victorian scholarship. The greatest benefit we owe to the artist, whether painter, poet, or novelist, is the extension of our sympathies. Appeals founded on generalisations and statistics require a sympathy ready-made, a moral sentiment already in activity. But a picture of human life such as a great artist can give surprises even the trivial and selfish into that attention to what is apart from themselves, which may be called the raw material of moral sentiment. Art is the nearest thing to life. It's a mode of amplifying experience and extending our contact with our fellow men beyond the bounds of our personal lot. Middlemarch, her great novel, perhaps her greatest novel, published at the beginning of the 1870s, has long been understood to be the central expression of Eliot's belief in the ethical and aesthetic importance of sympathy. Let's very briefly... Can I just see who's read Middlemarch in the room? Okay, great. Quite a few of you have. Because I'm not going to talk about it in much detail, so you'll have to sort of bear with me a bit. Let's briefly remind ourselves of what that sympathy looks like in a famous scene towards the novel's end when Dorothea Casaubon, Dorothea Brooke, who was the main female protagonist of the novel, is confronted simultaneously, she's now a widow, but she's confronted simultaneously with consciousness of the intensity and physical reality of her love for Will Ladislaw, the young man that she has sort of fallen in love with, but is barred from marrying, and the fact that this love has seemingly been bestowed on an unworthy man. What's happened is that Dorothea has called unannounced on Rosamond, the beautiful Rosamond Lydgate, married to the Dr. Lydgate, when mistakenly shown by a servant into the drawing room, she's witness to a tableau that hacks to pieces the altar of trust, as the narrator calls it, on which the baptism and consecration of her feeling for Will had been placed, on seeing him seated with his back to her, but his hands clasping the fair Rosamond's. Rosamond's a married woman. Dorothea's passions, her emotions, love, sexual jealousy, scorn, hatred, are intense. They're bodily as well as mental, and on her arrival back at her home, only the cold floor of her bedroom can provide an appropriate place for the night of anguish that follows. Nevertheless, by this point in the novel, we're really very near the novel's end, and Dorothea is no longer the naive girl at the beginning of the novel. She has resources. This is a quote, it's on the slide. It was not in Dorothea's nature for longer than the duration of a paroxysm to sit in the narrow cell of her calamity, in the besotted misery of a consciousness that only sees another's lot as an accident of its own. Destabilised by emotional pain, Dorothea nevertheless sets about doing sympathetic work. Her thoughts came quickly, producing a set of questions that I would argue do well as a blueprint of the catechistic practice of Eliotian sympathy. Reliving in memory the scene of the previous day, Dorothea asks, was she alone in that scene? Was it her event only? She forced herself to think of it as bound up with another woman's life. She forces herself out of her anguish and jealousy to think about the other woman in this scene. And I've given a couple more fragments here. It's a very famous passage of Middlemarch where Dorothea makes her way to a window and looks out, and she sees life outside her, this kind of extraordinary moment at her window. And she looks out and she finds in herself a capacity to identify with humanity in the wider world, and by doing so she finds herself afresh. It's an extraordinary moment of her selfhood. But in her next novel, and her final novel, Daniel Deronda, Eliot will sound an echo from this moment and use it to haunt the protagonist of that novel, Gwendolyn Harlowe. When Lydia Glasher's revelations at the Whispering Stones about Gwendolyn's suitor Grandcourt's amorous history, Grandcourt is courting Gwendolyn, but has had children with Lydia Glasher and refusing to marry her, and Lydia Glasher tells Gwendolyn this, provoke for Gwendolyn a ghastly vision coming as if in a dream and saying, I am a woman's life. No sympathetic response for Gwendolyn. In Daniel Deronda, another woman's life conjures only terrifying, hallucinatory or dreamlike modes. And this is at one amongst many signs in Daniel Deronda that something is amiss with sympathy, and that something is wider than can be accounted for by the simple fact that Gwendolyn lacks it. It's not that sympathy is less discussed or referenced. In fact, sympathy and its derivatives appear more frequently here than in any of her other books. It's rather that sympathy, in a sense, loses one side, and I think the side that's most distinctively Eliotian, of its moral force, as we saw it operating with Dorothea, where a self-reflexive and cognitive component, thoughts, her thoughts came quickly, she writes about Dorothea, is an essential aspect of sympathy's work. And the idea that sympathy is a kind of rational cognitive process is, I think, very important to Eliot, as it was to other critics like Leslie Stephen, Virginia Woolf's father, writing in his book On the Science of Ethics, put yourself in his place is not merely a moral precept, it's a logical rule implied in the earliest germs of reason as a description of reasoning itself. But in Daniel Deronda, what comes to the fore is another older association of sympathy as a kind of occult affinity, an earlier understanding of sympathy subsequently rendered into moral terms by David Hume in the 18th century in his assertion that, quotes, the minds of men are mirrors to each other, and in the Humean trope of contagion, you can catch feelings from someone else. An occult or gothic quality amidst the realist fabric of Daniel Deronda is something many critics have noticed. Writing after the appearance of the first of the eight parts that the novel was originally published in February 1876, the novelist Henry James saw that the threads of the narrative as we gather them into our hands are not of the usual commercial measurement, but long electric wires capable of transmitting messages from mysterious regions. Other critics, I put one here, have described it as a novel pervaded by ghosts and spirits, by forecasting, foresight and second sight, by strange intuitions, fantastical coincidences, instances of apparent telepathy or omniscience. I'm only going to have time to give the briefest example of this unsettled sympathy, but that's what I'm going to try and give now.